Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions. In a 6-2 ruling, the justices said Michigan did not violate the U.S. Constitution. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll discuss the High Court's ruling and its implications for affirmative action with our political analysts, Tim Hagel and Bruce Nesmith. Also on this Politics Day, the crisis in Ukraine, President Obama's visit to Asia, Republicans' views on same-sex marriage, and Hillary Clinton's campaign in waiting. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. First, a look at the news. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our guests this week, Bruce Nesmith, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Tim Hagel is in our Iowa City studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hello again, Tim.
Hey there.
Lots of things to chew over as we love to look at the latest developments on the political landscape. A little later in the program, we'll look at the Supreme Court decision that was announced yesterday saying that states may end racial preferences without violating the U.S. Constitution. And we'd like to have some listener input on that question. Your view of the latest Supreme Court decision that upheld Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions. Of course, this has to do with the long debate over affirmative action. 1-866-780-9100. We'll get to that a little bit later in the hour, but I wanted to reach out now so that we could have some input and you can be thinking about it. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave a comment or question, or certainly tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we get to that, let's deal with a couple of international issues. Yesterday, Vice President Joe Biden reiterated America's support of Ukraine while on a visit there after meeting with Ukrainian leaders in Kiev and pledging $50 million to the Ukrainian government. Vice President Biden reiterated U.S. support.
We stand with you. And it is not just a foreign policy judgment. It is a personal, it's an emotional commitment as well by millions of Americans.
Now, while in Ukraine, Biden also said that, quote, we call on Russia to stop supporting men hiding behind masks in unmarked uniforms, sowing unrest in eastern Ukraine. Senator John McCain, appearing on MSNBC's Morning Joe yesterday, responded to Biden's remarks with a question, or else what?
It's time, we said, the people of Ukraine deserve free and fair elections. They deserve our support. And no one in America wants boots on the ground. I totally accept that. But to keep telling everybody that, don't worry, we're not going to have boots on the ground. We're not going to have boots on the ground.
Right.
Can we go one press conference without saying that?
Okay. John McCain there. But Bruce Nesmith, so this back and forth on Ukraine, it continues. It seems like Senator McCain is talking about a sort of a game of chicken. No one wants American boots on the ground. That's acknowledged. But we shouldn't be saying it. But we should be pretending it's a possibility. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, I think on that subject, maybe the less said, the better. Not by me, of course, but perhaps by the president and vice president. The idea is that whether or not we say it, I think pretty much everybody in the universe knows that the U.S. is not going to go to war over Ukraine. How do we influence Russia's behavior and have some leverage over the outcome there without overcommitting or overbuying?
Mm-hmm. So we have a few options there. We have expanding economic sanctions. We have diplomacy, military option, which we talked about, not really a viable one. Do you see any of those working, Bruce?
Maybe not in the short run, but maybe in the long run. I think another option that might have more effect in the long run is to expand gas export, natural gas exports, which might involve expanding natural gas production as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that pretty much hits Russia where it hurts in there.
To make Western Europe in particular less dependent
right.
on Russian oil.
Yeah, and so
gas.
That so that's where they that's how they're able to fund all these adventures. And so if we are cut off their funding source, then that makes it more difficult for them to operate.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts on the continuing crisis in Ukraine?
Yeah, at least on the first part of that, the problem that any administration faces is if they immediately take certain options off the table, then that means that they no longer have those as leverage, even if we aren't going to have, as the phrase goes, boots on the ground. If you say that, then that means the other country or whoever it happens to be in opposition doesn't have to worry about that as an option. Even if we know we're not going to do that, we don't want them to know we're not going to do that or have that as an option. And as far as the trying to lessen the dependence of Western Europe on Russia, that makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, cool. The potential there is that it then means higher prices for us at home.
If we in Iowa on a talk show on public radio are talking about no boots on the ground being a definite thing, Putin has long since known that. So there is no secret, is there, that the U.S. is war weary and will not go to war in Ukraine for this cause?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly Putin knows that, but by constantly telling it and sort of, like I say, taking it off the table, then you just reduce your leverage. If you sort of have that idea that maybe at the extreme level this would happen, and it still might, but, like I say.
Let's talk about the president's trip to Asia, arriving in Japan today for the first part of an Asia trip. That started in Tokyo with the reassurance of U.S. support in its territorial dispute with China. This is a first stop in Tokyo, a week-long tour taking him to South Korea, Malaysia, the Philippines. Tim Hagel, can you talk about the president's goals on this trip? Incidentally, the first full state visit to Japan by a U.S. president since 1996.
Well, the president often goes on trips like this to help with trade issues, to help with other sorts of issues, to reassure our allies in various ways. But it's particularly important this time because of, as we were just talking about, what's going on in Ukraine, that the apparent, the Obama administration would argue that they are doing things, but from the point of view of several other people in other countries, that maybe the U.S. isn't doing enough, whether it's Ukraine or people will raise Syria and some other countries as issues here. And so there's a concern that potentially if Russia becomes more expansionist or China does in the case of Japan, will the United States come to the aid of these countries, whether it's in Asia or the NATO countries and so forth? And so that's one goal I think the president has, is to assure these other countries that, yes, we will honor our commitments in terms of your defense.
Mm-hmm. Also, hearkening back to our discussion about Ukraine, he's receiving a lot of criticism, not only from John McCain on foreign policy, but others in the Republican Party. Tim Hagel, is the Republican Party united in questions such as what to do in Ukraine?
Not particularly. Certainly, they're not happy with President Obama's particular policies right now, but in terms of what they would do, that's where it's a more of an open question. And certainly have John McCain as advocating for doing more, though something short of boots on the ground, as we were just saying. But then you have the Rand Paul position, which is more non-interventionist, and so they also generally don't like foreign aid. Now, how he would react in this particular situation, I haven't heard his latest speeches. I know he's been giving them, but it's usually a little bit different in terms of sort of sitting back and waiting until some other trigger occurs.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Nesmith, we've heard for years about a pivot to Asia. To what extent do you think that has succeeded under this administration?
Well, I don't think it's succeeded, but I don't know that the final outcome is certified yet. I think that a lot of presidents over the course of the years have, whatever their particular foreign policy goals, have found themselves dragged back to the Middle East. So, Obama's administration has spent a lot of time on Syria, and before that, Libya, and before that, Egypt. And at the same time, we're trying to bring the Israelis and Palestinians to the table once again. And it's hard, I think, when you're so focused on a region to develop contacts and sow the ground for future diplomacy in any other part of the world. And this is something that, Obama has wanted to do for a long time, and I think presidents before him have wanted to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So while in theory that's great for a president to say he's going to be, he or she, mm-hmm. I guess we should say, looking at 2016, proactive, it ends up being often reactive to world events, Tim Hagel.
Yeah, I think that's often true, though certainly the particular world events will depend that if things are relatively calm, that does give the president more of an opportunity to take that proactive stance and reach out to these other countries. It also helps if you have some foreign policy successes, and that's one of the problems that in the eyes of some, at least, where the Obama administration hasn't had the successes in places like Egypt and Libya and Syria and so forth, that then tends to make the other countries a little more concerned about the U.S.'s authority and prestige and influence and so forth.
Tim Hagel is with the University of Iowa. Bruce Nesmith with Coe College, two of our political analysts. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. Let's turn to this Supreme Court decision that was announced yesterday. Supreme Court yesterday morning upheld Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions. In a 6-2 ruling, the justices said the state did not violate the U.S. Constitution when its voters banned affirmative action. The justices say that a lower federal court was wrong to set aside the change as discriminatory. And just as a side note, a New York Times op-ed slammed what it called the Supreme Court's blinkered view of race in America after this decision. Well, what's the story behind this? Jennifer Gratz sued the University of Michigan in 1995 when she was not admitted, launching the debate that led affirmative action policies to be challenged in court. She calls yesterday's decision a victory.
My entire adult life has been spent trying to make sure that everyone, when they apply to college or for jobs or for contracts, is afforded an equal right to compete based on their character and their merit, not their skin color or their sex.
But Mark Rosenbaum, who argued in support of affirmative action in the Supreme Court case, says the playing field for minorities is still not level.
This isn't just an uneven playing field. It's two playing fields altogether, one of which is an obstacle course.
Okay, River to River listeners, what's your view of the latest Supreme Court decision that upheld Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Tim Hagel, you have a law degree. Give us an idea of the arguments here. What was before the court? Some context.
Well, let me start by saying that a lot of people characterize this as a ban on affirmative action, and it really wasn't. It was a ban on a particular form of affirmative action, and that's the racial preferences, and that's what the language in the amendment to the Michigan Constitution was banning, was certain racial preferences. But affirmative action itself as a term has sort of taken on that particular connotation, and even Justice Sotomayor in her dissent chose to avoid the term affirmative action and use the term race sensitive. But the idea is that the Supreme Court previously in cases like Bakke and even in not the Gratz case but the companion case of Grutter, where it allowed the University of Michigan Law School to continue to use race as a factor in its admissions, that was what caused the Michigan voters to say, no, we don't want to be able to do that. And so the question was, does the university or can the state's voters say, you know, maybe we're in favor of affirmative action, but just not this form of it. We don't want to have race, take race into consideration. Well, the opponents or the proponents of continuing to use racial preferences say that it would be discriminatory to not continue to use it. So it's sort of an odd argument that they're making where the one side says, well, we want to end discrimination by not discriminating in terms of the admissions policies, but the other side says, well, no, you have to continue to use race to end racial discrimination. So it's sort of odd arguments all around. And let me just kind of continue and say what the Supreme Court did was rather confusing itself, is that you had basically one, two, three, four different opinions by eight justices.
And that's unusual.
It's not totally unusual, but it was an 8-2 decision. Justice Kagan recused herself. She had been working on the case in earlier stages as Solicitor General, so she basically sat this one out. So it was a 6-2 decision, but of those six justices, you had three that were Kennedy, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito that were saying one thing, and they were trying to not overrule prior cases and say, well, here we're going to slide this case in between, saying that it's okay what Michigan did because it wasn't addressing a particular harm like some of the other cases that the lower courts had relied on to overturn and declare unconstitutional what Michigan did. And then you had two justices, Scalia and Thomas, that wanted to go much further and would just ban affirmative action altogether in terms of racial preferences. Justice Breyer, normally considered a liberal, joined the majority, but he also had sort of a different take on it in terms of how it happened. And then, of course, you have the two justices in dissent, Sotomayor and Ginsburg, who basically gave a full-throated defense to the use of racial preferences.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100. We want to see if there's an opinion out there on the latest Supreme Court decision, the opinion there that upheld Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions. Is it fair to say, Tim Hagel, that this is saying that voters in states are free to get rid of affirmative action without courts getting in the way?
Maybe.
Okay. You need to hedge that narrow.
Yeah, and that's why when you read the Kennedy's opinion that he, again, sort of treads a fine line between saying, well, these prior cases where voters had fashioned such a ban were inappropriate under those particular circumstances where the minority folks, the preferences were used to remedy a particular harm. And so Kennedy emphasized many times in his opinion that there was no particular harm. Now, Sotomayor would disagree, and the clip that you played earlier was saying, look, it's still an obstacle course. But the question is who has the opportunity to determine the correct course of action to change that? Is it the courts? And that was a very activist opinion by Sotomayor. Or should the voters be allowed to weigh in on what they feel is the appropriate method. And let me also just kind of throw in here, too, that Chief Justice Roberts, in a very short opinion, also sort of said, look, there is going to be a difference of opinion on these issues, and you shouldn't demonize the other side by having a different opinion.
Okay. Mary is joining us from Iowa City, has a view on this Supreme Court decision. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, as an African-American, I'm not even going to concern myself about affirmative action because according to the Department of Census, the population will be reversed and then affirmative action will come right back on the scene. And if you want an international view of affirmative action, look at Ukraine. The Russian speakers are being protected by the Russians so that we think we're isolated in our little, you know, cultural wars here. But this has international, you know, branches out there. And another thing, it should be something about ageism. We're having a problem here in Iowa City about our senior center. Certain members of the city council want to close our senior center down. So we're in desperate mode here. So okay. That's like diversity, but another okay. form of it.
Okay, Mary, tying a lot of issues together from Ukraine right down to the senior center in Iowa City. Mary, thank you for your call from Iowa City. Bruce, weigh in on this Supreme Court decision with your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, as so often when domestic policies go to the courts, there's several layers. It's kind of like an onion. And so one of the questions has to do with what is the constitutional obligation here? And another question might be, what is desirable policy? And a third question might be, what is a desirable policy process? Who should be making these decisions? And those last two are not, I mean, we could argue about whether affirmative action is good or necessary, and we could argue about whether the state voters or the university itself or who should be making admissions decisions at the university. But those are not constitutional questions. And so I think the court ruled correctly that in the absence of a previous finding of discrimination, in the absence of a federal law governing University of Michigan behavior, that the state of Michigan is able to not have this part of their admissions requirements. Mm-hmm. Considerations, not requirements.
Do you think this, when we look at a longer view of the court's actions on race issues, Tim Hagel, do you think this is part of a trend?
That's a good question. It's a trend in the sense that these cases constantly come up, and that's one of the things that in particular Justice Scalia complains about, is that the court, the majority in any given case, is constantly trying to find some particular solution that serves an individual case and that doesn't make a broader policy, or at least that's what happened in this particular case because, as I said, Justice Kennedy in his opinion tried to find a way to not overturn the prior cases that were relied on by the lower courts and still suggest that it was appropriate for what the Michigan voters did in this particular instance, but then also still allow for the possibility of racial preferences being used in other contexts. So it's basically up to the voters of the state. If they had wanted to continue to use them, that would be fine. If they chose not to use them, that would be fine. And that's basically what Kennedy said. Scalia says, no, you shouldn't do that. Sotomayor from the other side says, no, you shouldn't do that. And so until we sort of get to the point where you have enough justices that will go one way or the other saying, yes, it's always going to be okay, or no, it's not, we're going to constantly have these cases that sort of tick away at various aspects of this that in a sense should help us to understand the broader picture, but often don't.
Couple minutes before we have to take a break, but let's get our caller in from Tiffin on this issue. Your name, I'm not quite sure what your name is in Tiffin, please.
Janine.
Hi, Janine. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. I believe in affirmative action, but I don't think it should be based on race. I think it should be based on economics. I think poor people should get help, you know, going to college and getting ready for college, that mm-hmm. sort of thing, because not all minorities are disadvantaged and not all majorities are advantaged. And I don't think you can remedy what happened 50 years ago or 250 years ago or even 20 years ago. You can only work with what is happening right now.
Okay. Thank you very much, our caller from Tiffin. I'm sorry about that. So, Tim, can this be used as a means of preferential treatment, affirmative action, I guess?
Certainly it can, and that's at least in the terms of race, that's what the court in previous cases has said, that race can be a factor in a state university has a compelling interest in having a diverse student body and the benefits that flow from that. And so that's when in Bakke, University of California versus Bakke back in the late 70s, the court allowed that. And so that's sort of the first case where affirmative action and race has been used. But in other instances where states have said in one way or another that, no, we don't want you to use racial preferences, but that doesn't mean that they can't use other methods to try to increase the minority population of a school.
Mm-hmm. But you can look at need instead of race.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what many states have done. Need and basically if you have schools that – like in Texas, one of their approaches was to say, well, we'll take – at our university, we'll take anybody in the top 10%, 15%, 25%. And so, of course, if you have a lot of schools that have a large minority population, then that means that you'll automatically take those folks and increase the minority population at your university or college.
Tim Hagel is with us from the University of Iowa. Bruce Nesmith from Cole College. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. When we come back, I want to talk about – I want to ask our guests about, well, what is expected to be a Supreme Court case in the future that will deal with same-sex marriage, in coupling that with a poll among Republican voters just out about their views on same-sex marriage and retirement. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg turned 81 last month. A lot of chatter about that retirement. We'll talk about what thoughts go into a retirement when you're a Supreme Court justice. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Up to 2 million women and children worldwide are victimized by traffickers each year. While it's often thought as a problem outside of our borders, the majority of sex trafficking victims are within the U.S., are U.S. citizens also, some of which call Iowa home. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at the prevalence of human trafficking and what is being done to raise awareness and eliminate the practice. That's tomorrow on River to River. Politics Wednesday here on River to River with Bruce Nesmith of Coe College and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our political analysts, as we churn through some of the latest developments on the political landscape. We're talking a lot the last half hour about the latest Supreme Court decision that upheld Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions. Related to that, the U.S. Supreme Court, a lot of chatter over the past months, Tim Hagel, about when the court will be, I don't know if forced is the right term, but when the court will take on a case that has to do with same-sex marriage. We've had such a change in attitudes, but also in laws in the U.S. in the last only 5 years. So how is that determined when the U.S. Supreme Court will take such a case on?
Well, there are a couple of different factors that go into it. One is the particular justices on the court, whether they're willing to hear a particular type of case. And certainly for policy reasons, some justices might want to hear cases earlier or later. And of course, it depends on the particular case. Generally, they like to see a little bit more development in the law, either in the state courts or the lower federal courts, before they decide to jump into any particular issue. And a lot of times what will happen is that you'll have, particularly in the federal courts, different courts of appeals that will reach different decisions on a particular issue. That you may have one court of appeals that says, yes, this is okay, another says, no, it's not. And when you have that, what's called a circuit conflict, that's when you're more likely to have U.S. Supreme Court step in to resolve such conflicts.
Mm-hmm. That being said, do you have an idea, a sense of when the U.S. Supreme Court will face this case, take on a case that will decide it for all states?
I really don't. As you're saying that the issue is becoming more prevalent, and what we're seeing is a number of issues that are popping up that people perhaps didn't think about it initially. That, well, it's okay to say, all right, well, the state can approve gay marriage either judicially or legislatively, what have you. But what does that mean then if a couple goes to another state that doesn't recognize it? What does it mean in terms of divorce? What does it mean in terms of any other rights and so forth? And so you have those issues that are coming up before the court, and you're going to have other issues just even if the parties stay in the same state and go through a divorce process or other settlement sorts of things. And so at this point, the law is very unsettled. And that's why I think that it might be a while yet before it goes to the Supreme Court, or at least before the Supreme Court actually accepts such a case, unless it's a clear sort of case where they're easily able to what we call summarily affirm or reverse, that the law is such that they can simply say yes, affirm, yes, reverse based on past precedent without having to get into the policy issues themselves.
A poll released yesterday shows that most Republican voters remain firmly rooted in opposition to same-sex marriage. It was a poll commissioned by some conservative groups, American Values and the Family Research Council. A poll taken last month sampled 800 Republican and Republican-leaning independents. They were described as such. 82% saying they agree that a marriage should be confined as being between only a man and a woman. 75% completely disagree that public officials should be working to redefine the institution to include same-sex couples. Now, that's a position that runs counter to what as other polls have indicated. For instance, a CBS New York Times poll taken in February showing more than half, 56% of the country population backing legalizing same-sex marriage. Where do you see this going in the political realm, Bruce Nesmith?
Well, I think there's one thing that other studies have shown is that there is movement among all groups in favor of same-sex marriage. And I think, 82%, that's not that's pretty overwhelming, and it is. But a decade or two ago, it might have been 100%. So even among groups that are currently staunchly opposed to same-sex marriage, the prevalence of that view is becoming less. I think there's kind of two aspects to this in terms of politics, which is that if we see that societal views on this are changing to the point where there might be more popular support for gay marriage or gay adoption or any other sort of version of the gay rights issue, then we might see, as we have seen in the last decade or so, attempts to freeze the situation by using the state constitutions to prevent those from being recognized, because constitutional provision is harder to overrule than a law or a court decision or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think is one. On the other hand, people who support it might try to press that perception, looking at particular groups that are key in future elections, such as young people or women or some other group that might be. I think young people is probably a better example.
But assuming the attitudes shift, and I guess there's disagreement as to how fast and how far they are shifting. But
right.
Bruce, won't, for instance, the Republican Party at some point have to embrace same-sex marriage if we see these shifts continue? How do you see that happening, Bruce?
Well, I think it comes to it depends on how far it shifts. Whether the shift continues and just becomes overwhelmingly popular, such as with Social Security, or is it a shift that remains a strong minority view among Republicans and maybe the overall American population is somewhat split on that.
Tim Hagel, we have several camps within the GOP, the Libertarian Tea Party wing, the mainstream part of the party, also the Christian conservatives. How do you see this issue playing out in those various camps as we move through the years?
Well, actually, it's not even so much those camps that I would mention as that as sort of a caller that was mentioning before, the generational effect that among younger Republicans, they just don't see it as a major issue, that they, even more than older Republicans, are focused more on economic sorts of things and often tend to have a more libertarian point of view.
Mm-hmm. But if you have a young Republican who has a GOP platform that is against same-sex marriage, couldn't that drive away a younger voter?
It potentially could, although the thing with party platforms is that candidates will often say, well, I didn't read it or whatever. And so sometimes platforms can be used against candidates, but a lot of times candidates at this point know how to avoid those sorts of pitfalls. But I think that, certainly if a party has a platform, whether it's at the national level, state level, what have you, that it can be certainly used by the opposition to potentially drive potential voters of that party away from them. But I think that you'll also likely see where some states have removed those types of planks from their platform. It's not that they're necessarily accepting of same-sex marriage or whatever the particular issue is, but it's more of a tolerance. And that's sort of where we're seeing the breakdown now, that there's much more tolerance for it. But the question is how far does the acceptance have to go? And that's where we saw recently with arguments over the photographer who chose not to photograph a same-sex wedding because it was against his or her beliefs, but then was sued as a result. And those sorts of issues as to whether you can say, well, look, it's fine for you, but I don't want to be part of it. Are you still able to do that if you're in business and so forth? So those are the types of issues that we're going to start to see at this point. In addition to the basic issues, as obviously many states still don't allow same-sex marriage, but it's kind of a dual track.
Let's briefly turn back to the Supreme Court, our theme from the first half hour. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg turning 81 last month. There's been debate about whether she should retire, and the flames of that Ginsburg retirement talk were most recently fanned by her once colleague, retired Justice John Paul Stevens, telling ABC's George Stephanopoulos that it was acceptable to take politics into account in deciding when to step down. Tim, with you, with the legal background here, and you've written about the topic of Supreme Court retirements, place this talk of Ginsburg's retirement in context. How should a Supreme Court justice know when it is time to retire? Are there any written rules, or is it so individual, completely up to that justice?
That's the nice thing about life tenure is you get to decide, unless health decides for you in some cases. And in the case of Thurgood Marshall, for instance, he had long said that he was going to stay on the court until he died, but he became so ill that it just was no longer possible for him to stay. And sometimes it catches up with you, like with Justice Rehnquist, although he had been sick for a number of months before he actually died. I think he was still planning on staying on for another year or so, given that Justice O'Connor had already indicated she wanted to retire. And so that created two vacancies at once, which the justices tend to not like to have. Generally, even though the justices will claim that they don't take political considerations, usually they do, or at least there's a certain if nothing else, a statistical coincidence then that, in fact, they do seem to. And certainly they don't like to retire during an election year because they don't often like to have the judicial politics embroiled in the campaign politics. But in a situation like we have right now where it's not likely that Justice Ginsburg is going to stay on for many more years. She could. Certainly other justices have stayed on into their 90s. But you know, she's been had ill health before, and people are thinking, well, maybe it would be a good time for her to retire. And the idea here is that as a liberal justice, that it would give President Obama an opportunity to appoint a much younger liberal justice who would then stay on the court as part of his legacy for many years to come. From Justice Ginsburg's point of view, that the best representative of her ideology is her, so she should stay on for a while. But the problem is that if, in fact, the Democrats lose the Senate in the 14 elections, that then it would make it even harder for President Obama to get somebody on the court who he wants, which is to say sufficiently liberal to carry out his view of things, get past a Republican Senate. On the other hand, in thinking about this earlier today, if Justice Ginsburg were to retire, and even though it would create this sort of confluence of judicial and electoral politics,
Announce retirement yet this year?
And at the end of the term, like in a couple of months, and so that we would go through this process this summer, it would be a diversionary issue, to get it away from things that perhaps hurt the Democrats more. And if President Obama were to do something like nominate the first black woman to the Supreme Court, Republicans would have a very hard time of opposing her, regardless of her ideological point of view.
Mm-hmm. And we presume there are candidates out there that would be on a short list.
There are lots of judges out there, and Obama certainly would have his choice of who he would want to put on.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, Politics Wednesday with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa and Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. Let's talk a little bit about women in politics. So we heard many of our listeners heard the piece by NPR's Mara Liasson this week examining the grassroots campaign that is built around Hillary Rodham Clinton, her presidential run in 2016, even before this potential candidate has announced her intentions. A veteran Clinton campaign pollster, Jeff Guerin, says efforts like Ready for Hillary are examples of how campaigns have changed.
There are a lot of entities that are not the campaign proper that have a huge influence on the outcomes of elections. We've seen that infrastructure be deployed in 2012. Now that infrastructure is really getting ready to support Hillary Clinton if she decides to run.
Okay, it's an interesting piece. We've posted that link to the entire piece on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. Let's talk for a moment about how campaigns have changed in 2014. Bruce, how important is this kind of grassroots effort to be successful, to run for the president? We're more than 2 years away from 2016, and we hear very clearly in this piece that the grassroots infrastructure building is ramping up rapidly.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of things going on here. One is that candidates are much less in control of their campaigns than they used to be, partly because of the popularity of PACs and partly because of social media. It's just really hard it's really easy to organize something. I think I was impressed in 2000, to kind of take a step back from this, at how well George W. Bush, when he was running for the Republican nomination, created a sense of inevitability around his nomination. And I think Hillary Clinton is doing the same thing, that it's almost hard to think about anybody else who might be the Democratic presidential candidate in 2016. Not a prediction. I'm just saying that that's the vibe that she's been able to create. And certainly this group, these groups help her to create that vibe. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if she has a particular message that she wants to get out and it's not that group's message, then she doesn't control them.
Tim Hagel, with the amount of hype over Hillary as a candidate, is that a good or a bad thing for the Democrats? We tend to think it's a good thing. They can unify behind a candidate, but it is blocking the way for other Democrats, other women potentially, for rising and being considered.
Once again, I'll take the both position. You know, there are pros and cons to these kinds of things, that in a certain sense, if you're a candidate and you can clear the field, as it were, say that basically if you get into the race, it pretty much means that everybody else is going to get out, or you freeze the field, so to speak, which is what's happening now. That can be good because then your party doesn't engage in a nasty and expensive primary battle. And of course, at the presidential level, that's very expensive and can get very nasty depending on the circumstances. On the other hand, if somehow that inevitable candidate stumbles in some way, then that can really hurt that particular party if it turns out that that person has not been sufficiently tested in a campaign process going out to the individual states and so forth. And even for the general election, if this is a person, and this is to some extent the problem with Hillary Clinton back in 2008, that because she was so well known that perhaps she didn't think she needed to do the kinds of grassroots activities to build coalitions here in Iowa or wherever it happens to be, and it hurt her. And so you had somebody who was lesser known, like then Senator Barack Obama, who came in and did the grassroots organizing that at least here in Iowa we like, and was able to ride that effort to success. And so there are pros and cons to that inevitability, and we just kind of have to wait and see how it shakes out, or even if she gets into the race. Although right now, if she doesn't get into race, we're still pretty early, but certainly it's going to hurt some of the Democrats if they're not thinking strongly enough about it. And all of a sudden it's, oh, she's not running. Well, I guess I better start thinking about this.
Bruce Nesmith, back to your point about the modern parties, modern candidates losing control over their campaigns, these grassroots networks not directed from the top necessarily. Is that from the candidate's point of view, is that a good or a bad thing?
I'll get into the Tim swing of things here and say both. It's a good thing because you can project yourself farther into the public debate than your own particular campaign resources would ordinarily allow. So, the Republican Senate candidates in Iowa, for example, are really operating a low level of visibility and low level of fundraising, but Americans for Prosperity is able to put forth ads that project certain themes that they may or may not find useful, probably will, at least in the short run. On the other hand, campaigns are about branding and messages and things like that, and if you have no control over a group that may have a voice as loud as yours, even though they're on your side, you may not be able to shape the brand or the message in the way that you would like.
Jim and Spencer is with us. We've got a couple minutes left of the hour. Jim, we wanted to include a question that has another issue in question. Jim, go ahead.
Sure. Apparently, from what I'm understanding now, the IRS has decided that they don't have the energy or the resources to pursue political campaigning from the pulpit, religious nonprofits. Is that something that we're going to need to start thinking about, or what do you guys think about that?
Okay, this has to do with the investigation, I believe, led by Daryl Issa. Can you perhaps, Tim Hagel, give us an update on that, or are you following that?
I haven't heard anything particular that's going on, and I think maybe the stuff that's going on with Daryl Issa and the IRS investigation, Lois Lerner and targeting Tea Parties, may be a little bit different than what the caller was suggesting.
Okay.
There's always been a little bit of an issue in terms of the extent to which pastors, reverends, and so forth can – in their sermons and so forth, advocate for positions or candidates. Usually they have to be careful about not advocating for candidates. They can give informational sorts of things. But because they're nonprofit, that they have to walk a fine line. And if the IRS apparently doesn't have a lot of personnel, in fact, I'd heard a story recently where the chances of getting audited has dropped considerably because, again, the IRS doesn't have the personnel, in part because they've got to shift personnel over to Obamacare and some of the regulations there. So, it could be.
Jim, was that more the vein that you were talking about?
Yeah, and I'm aware of certain campaigns that are actually candidates are actually speechifying from inside churches as of right now. So, just wanted to know if anybody was worried about that.
Okay, Jim, thank you for your call from Spencer. We have a minute or so. Bruce Nesmith, what will you be watching in the coming weeks?
Well, I just wanted to pipe up on that particular question.
Oh,
this has been going on for a long time. The laws are what they are, but they've been pretty widely flouted on both sides for a long, long time. I'm interested to see what's going on in Israel and Palestine. The Palestinian parties have formed a unity government, which is something that they haven't had for a long, long time, at least, I think, 10 years. Does this help the peace talks? Does this not help the peace talks? Does it at least help Palestine to get their affairs in order?
Okay. What's on your radar, Tim Hagel, as we leave in a few seconds?
Well, I'm going to go more local, and basically the primaries that are coming up in June, some interesting races, the 1st District Democratic primary to replace Bruce Braley, and the Iowa GOP Senate race, third congressional district, too. So all those are going to be very interesting.
Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, where he's Associate Professor of Political Science. Bruce Nesmith by phone, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coke College. Bruce and Tim, always great to have you on the program. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about human trafficking, sex trafficking. It's not just a problem outside our borders. It happens right here in Iowa. We'll talk about the prevalence of human trafficking and what's being done to raise awareness and eliminate the practice. Tomorrow on our program, River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.